Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Gordon Chang, Forbes.com contributor, is here with me. He is in Hong Kong, very close to where the asteroid will strike within the next 24 minutes. The asteroid strike, otherwise known as the Chinese mainland stock markets. They have been crashing as only an asteroid can crash the planet Earth in these last 3 weeks, anticipated by Mr. Chang. For the last months, we've been talking about the bubble, the bull bubble in China. The question here is not that markets go up and down, prices are high, prices are low, everything recovers, good buying opportunity, I understand. Question here is, what is the connection between the plunging stock market, the troubled economy, I'm being diplomatic, and the burst of nationalism we've seen in China this last year, and the corruption campaign launched by Xi Jinping, and the cult of personality, Maoist personality around the president of China? Are they all different phenomena, or do they connect? Gordon, a very good evening to you in Hong Kong. The asteroid is not going to strike for another 30 minutes, so let's speak of a visit by a very significant senior military figure, Chinese military figure, to Washington recently. And you write most recently that it might be that he was slighted. What does that event have to do with the pending visit of Xi Jinping with this nationalism prize that we're seeing developed in China? Good morning to you.
Well, good evening, John. General Fan Chunlong, who is vice chairman of the Central Military Commission of the Communist Party, visited Washington last month, and he was slighted. First of all, he is the first vice chairman in at least two decades, and maybe in history, who has not had an opportunity to visit a sitting American president. President Obama specifically turned down a meeting with General Fan. Also, when General Fan had his welcoming ceremony at the Pentagon, he did not get the customary 19-gun salute, and in what was very conspicuous, most senior U.S. officials and officers did not attend the ceremony. Now, this is important because General Fan didn't come to Washington for a low-profile visit. He brought one of the biggest delegations with him, and he also brought people from the General Political Department of the People's Liberation Army. Indeed, he did not want to fly under the radar.
We welcome Charles Burton, professor at Brock University, to help us understand the Communist Party as it is now struggling with the stock market, with the sluggish economy, with the South China Sea, and now with this diplomatic slight, if that's what it was, in Washington, the pending visit of Xi Jinping, and the anticipation of Chinese nationalism drum beating, celebrating the victory over the Japanese in the Second World War 70 years ago in September, right after the state visit by the president of China. Charles, I've laid a number of dots on the table. Do they connect? Is this all coming swirling together? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Yes, I think that it's all of a piece. I mean, certainly the U.S. government's shunning of this senior Chinese military official suggests that Mr. Obama is going to emphatically repudiate President Xi's notion that the United States and China should have great power relations, whereby the United States acknowledges China's preeminence over Asia, and that China would acknowledge the United States' preeminence over North America. And so that discourse is clearly not something that the U.S. government is prepared to buy into. And I think not giving the Chinese military delegation the kind of affirmation that they were hoping for by all these 19-gun salutes and high-level visits is indicative that the lines are being drawn and that the United States and China have a fundamental disagreement over the nature of China's future role in the global community. So I think that that's certainly one point. I think also the United States, as all of us, are unhappy with this military parade marking the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. China has never done this before, to have a major celebration of the defeat of the Japanese. And clearly China is trying to remake the discourse to deal the United States out of the story. I mean, you know, the United States was a singular supporter of the nationalist regime, the Kuomintang, that genuinely defeated the Japanese. The United States were the were the Flying Tigers that were sending much-needed supplies over the Burma Road. And after all, the Japanese were not defeated by the Chinese Communist Party armies, but were defeated by the bombs, the atomic bombs over Hiroshima. But those things are not going to be in this new discourse, which suggests that the People's Republic of China was established on the basis of removing the Japanese colony that China had become and dealing out the Americans and dealing out the nationalists as legitimate participants in the creation of modern China.
Gordon?
Charles, as a proud American, I would never say that we had predominance over North America, and I'm sure that you Canadians would agree with me on that score. But with regard to the rest of your points, I think what's important, and you mentioned this, and that is that if you look at the history of World War II in China, it was the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek that did about 95, maybe 99% of the fighting. And what strikes me is dangerous for the party right now is to say, as you point out, deal out the nationalists, deal out the Americans, deal out everybody else, and make it appear that Mao Zedong defeated the Japanese single-handedly. This is something that Kim Il-sung in North Korea tried to do, except he dealt out the Chinese as well. Going forward, do you think that the Chinese people are going to buy this narrative, which I assume that they would, but isn't there danger for the party in trying to enforce a version of history that is manifestly untrue?
Well, I think that that is part of this sort of regime that is built, in fact, on lies. And I do think that there will be great receptiveness to the major propaganda push that the Communist Party is putting out to develop this new discourse. They're going to put out 20 documentaries, 12 TV dramas, 3 animated programs. They've already got 180 children's programs that are on this theme of the heroism of the Chinese Communist Party in liberating China from Japanese domination. And I think it will be received by an element within China that is strongly nationalistic and amenable to populist kinds of overtures. So I think it is a very dangerous ideology because, as you say, it's not based on the truth, and certainly the implications of it for international relations in East Asia are very much at odds with the vision of the world that currently prevails, dominated by the United States, which is that the world should be one where there are peaceful relations between democracies and free trade. And the way that China wants to do it is to create spheres of influence that China will continue to expand, claiming that the United States has a similar sphere of influence in Europe and North America, which, as you point out, is not the way the United States sees its role in global relations.
Gordon, is there a linkage, any linkage, propaganda, military, between the declining economy, the rough patch they've hit in their capitalist trend, and the burst of nationalism and the aggression in the South China Sea and the provocation towards the Japanese?
Yeah, they're all occurring at the same time, and I think that there is a linkage. And the reason is, as everybody has pointed out, for more than 35 years, the Communist Party's primary basis of legitimacy is the continual delivery of prosperity. And they have, I think, been insecure about that for quite some time, which is the reason why they blew up this stock market bubble that is now collapsing on them. And so essentially what they're doing is they're talking today, John, and just a couple hours ago, the Chinese Communist Party was talking about the quote-unquote patriotic fight to keep the stock markets up. And so what we're seeing is this nationalist theme really sort of pervading everything, not only the issue of World War II, but also the fight to save China's economy.
Charles, you have to love the idea that the Chinese Communist Party is going to defy gravity, or as they used to say in the stock market, catch a falling knife. Are they that powerful? Are they going to rearrange the cosmos as we understand it, Charles, and defy gravity?
Well, I certainly think that that would require significant rewriting of the laws of economics, and I don't think that that is likely to be the case. And certainly, I think the expectation of people in China is that the Chinese Communist Party, while it has denied them democracy and the rights of citizenship and democratic freedoms, was supposed to be providing the Chinese people with ever rising living standards, particularly the important middle class. And if a lot of people in the middle class, because of this margin purchases of stocks, are finding their their savings wiped out, their medical, their risky stock market ventures being their medical insurance and their retirement plan, that this will then cause people to think the bargain doesn't seem to be being fulfilled by the party, because not only do they have a repressive authoritarian regime on top of them limiting their freedoms, but also the party is not delivering the promised improvements in their living standards that has been part of the bargain really since the resolution of the Tiananmen Incident in 1989.
Final detail, Gordon. When is the President of China due in Washington?
I don't think the date has been set, but we know that September 3 is the date of the big military parade in Beijing that you guys have been talking about. It's probably going to be just after the UN General Assembly meeting in New York in September. That's when they usually settle these things.
September is an important date. Look forward to the provocation and what it brings in Asia, and then the visit of the President of China after the dislocation of the economy and the challenge to Japan in Asia. Our treaty ally, Japan, our treaty ally, I emphasize again, mutual defense treaty with Tokyo. If it's attacked, we're attacked. Gordon Chang, Charles Brock, I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. My colleague and co-host Gordon Chang, Forbes.com contributor, is in Hong Kong, and we're joined by Greg Scarlatti to report to us on a horrible story. This is a challenge to everyone who understands human beings. There are reports, and according to the news, the reports are backed up by a new defector from North Korea, Jong Ji Sung-ho, that the North Korean regime, under this dictator and the previous dictator, practicing chemical and biological warfare tests on disabled adults and children in North Korea. I told you, that's about as bad as it gets for human beings. Greg, a very good evening to you. Thank you. You have mentioned in your reports to me that we've heard stories about this for some time. This defector, he's written up in the Telegraph in London. Did he bring out evidence that's convincing? Is this going to change the story? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. Sure. If confirmed, this is going to be a game changer. We also see a pattern in North Korea. In the 1990s, when defectors and political prison camp survivors such as Kang Chol-hwan told their story to the world, that story was met with skepticism, even by human rights organizations, large-scale grassroots human rights organizations. Satellite imagery provided the scientific hard evidence that confirmed the existence of these political prison camps, irrefutably confirmed the existence of these political prison camps. Under Kim Jong-un, we've had reports that North Korea is using ZPU-4 anti-aircraft machine gun systems, 50 caliber machine gun systems, to execute purged officials. Our organization, HRNK, and All Source Analysis came up with a satellite image snapped just minutes before such an execution. If confirmed, this report and this information would provide irrefutable evidence that North Korea does conduct experimentation on human subjects. We've had these reports for years, though, John. We've had Kwon Hyuk, a former security official at political prison camp number 22, who described incidents where healthy prisoners were placed inside glass chambers into which gas was inserted while technicians observed their deaths. We've had reports from a former Special Operations Forces member, Im Tong-yong, who a few years ago stated that similar experiments took place on an island in the Yellow Sea. Of course, this is the world's most reclusive regime. This is a very close society. These reports are extremely difficult to confirm, but that final piece of evidence is always that scientific hard evidence, and that's what we hope this defector is going to provide.
Gordon?
Greg, the UN General Assembly voted to refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The UN Security Council has got to do that itself, and many people think that China is going to veto any referral of its ally, North Korea. Do you think that this report, as horrific as it is, will change that calculus, or will the Chinese maintain their posture and protect North Korea with its veto?
I would think that if confirmed, such a report would be a game changer, not enough to persuade China to change its strategic stance on North Korea. However, if this report provides irrefutable confirmation that experimentation on human subjects is happening at North Korea's political prison camps, the political price of unconditionally supporting a regime that's committing crimes against humanity, the Kim regime, is only going to get higher. And remember, Gordon and John, the UN Commission of Inquiry on North Korean Human Rights, while addressing the issue of the forcible repatriation of North Korean refugees by China, has cautioned China that by forcibly repatriating North Korean refugees, China is aiding and abetting a regime that's committing crimes against humanity.
Gordon, does China pay a price for this, presuming that the confirmation of Ji Song Ho's information?
Well, I think China will pay the price. Up to now, it has, in a sense, suffered reputational damage because of its unconditional support of North Korea. But nonetheless, China has believed that because it looks so powerful otherwise, that it can do whatever it wants to help North Korea or, for that matter, Zimbabwe. The point here, though, is that, you know, as we watch China's economy fall apart, people are going to pay less respect to Beijing. And so, therefore, you know, that we will probably see that game changer that Greg talks about, because then countries are not going to be intimidated by Beijing. And I think that they will find their better instincts.
Greg, we have less than a minute. At this point, what's the timeline for this? Ji Song Ho is mentioned in the Telegraph. How long do we think we need to wait for confirmation?
We should know for sure by the end of the month, based on what we have seen in the press. Now, certainly this could be a game changer. There have been so many other game changers.
Right.
North Korea's political prison camps, the unspeakable cruelty of this regime. Let us hope that finally this is going to be the final straw that will turn the tide.
Greg Scarlatte, who is Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Gordon Chang, a Forbes.com contributor. He's in Hong Kong. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Later tonight, historian Nick Bunker, how Boston, a mere 17,000 people, turned the world upside down when it threw the East India Company's tea into Boston Harbor, December 1773. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. David Grinspoon, Dr. David Grinspoon, distinguished visiting scholar in astrobiology, Library of Congress, and here to help us on planetary geology as the New Horizons probe from NASA approaches first time in history. Glimpses, close glimpses, good views of one hemisphere of the planet Pluto, the dwarf planet Pluto. In addition, it has a system of at least five, we'll call them satellites, and their origins are in question. We're just going to get a flyby now, so we'll start with what we can glimpse so far as New Horizons approaches. David, a very good evening to you. The first glimpse we get is that there is variety in the surface of Pluto. There's a dark area and there are light areas, there are shapes. What do we make so far of Pluto and its five satellites? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, it's been a very exciting approach to Pluto. You know, it's been 9 years since the launch, and we're now basically a week away from the encounter, or one Pluto day away. And it's been a little bit too exciting. There was a spacecraft glitch. We lost contact, and now everything seems to be fine. But when that happens this close, you get nervous because we only get one shot at this. Fortunately, they analyzed and solved the problem, and it's not something that is expected to happen again. Meanwhile, we approach and we start to see detail on the surface, and it's so tantalizing. It's like a Rorschach test, an inkblot test that's kind of morphing as we watch. And of course, it's tempting to speculate, and we can, but we also do this in the knowledge that a few days from now, everything we see will, everything we think will seem hopelessly outdated and primitive. But nonetheless, one thing that's striking is that, as you said, the surface is variable, and there are light and dark areas. And I'm noticing that the boundaries between these light and dark and intermediate areas seem very sharp. And that's got me wondering if we're possibly seeing tectonic boundaries, which would be really cool if there was some remnant of some kind of internally driven geological activity. You can get these kind of boundaries also just from moving around of volatile material, evaporating and condensing ices and gases. And certainly we expect some degree of that kind of activity happening on Pluto. You know, I hesitate to speculate further because, as I said, it's all going to be dashed away. I have all our ideas.
One question then about the five satellites. There was a school that said that these were captured items from, say, the outer solar system. But there's another school that indicated this could be the product detritus from a collision. Do we know enough to say which way we want to go at this point, David?
Well, the largest moon, Charon, is almost certainly the product of a collision, because as with the Earth-Moon pair, Pluto and Charon have this quality of, it's an unusual pair in that the moon is very sizable. It's a sizable chunk of the primary, and it seems like probably to get that kind of a pair, you need to have had a giant collision. Now, whether these other moons were also formed in that same collision is a really interesting, or whether they might be captured, these other much tinier moons, is an interesting question. And perhaps we'll learn something about the composition of these small bodies and see how they're related to one another, which will help us solve that mystery in next week's encounter.
Rushing from one dwarf planet, Pluto, to another dwarf planet. This is Ceres, where the NASA probe Dawn is in orbit now, and it's giving us photographs, and we're fascinated with two landscape phenomena on the surface. I'll begin with the 3-kilometer-high pyramid. I say pyramid because it looks like a pyramid shape, but it's a landscape that is flat all around it. Is this striking similar to something else we've ever seen, David? Is there a quick explanation for why we would see such a prominent terrain feature and nothing like it around it?
Well, it's really weird, to use a technical term. And of course, when we mention a pyramid on another planet, the hotlines are going to light up, conspiracy theorists. But it is odd, and you know, there are certainly roughly pyramid shaped features that we see on Earth due to tectonic motions of the crust. And you know, if I had to speculate, I would say this has something to do with some kind of tectonics, perhaps eroded impact mountains. You know, multiple impacts that left some remnant of the crust up at these strange angles. But I'm glad that with the Dawn spacecraft, we're going to be getting a closer look at these features on Ceres and really be able to map out the composition and the topography with much more detail with the later phases of the mission. Because I think what we're seeing so far is that, there are questions and mysteries being raised, and we need better data to be able to resolve them, but fortunately that better data is coming our way.
Right, Don. Now, the spot number one, NASA gave us a probe, a very detailed picture of the bright spots. We've seen them from great distances, and now Don is returning very good images. There's a crater, and in the crater and on the edges of the crater and radiated out from the crater is what looks like somebody dropped a pound of flour on it. There's nothing else like it in the landscape around it. These bright spots stick out, and there are not that many of them. Is there a guess, David, right now, a guess what we're looking at? Is there anything like this in our solar system?
Well, it is quite odd. As you say, you know, it looks like something sort of splattered on the surface. Now, why should that be the case? That might be an illusion. I still think that this is quite likely to be fresh ice that's sort of punching up from below and is partially covered up with darker detritus on the surface. But, you know, we don't know. And what we really need is to map out the topography so we can see, you know, is this, are these features associated with depressions, or are they raised above the surface? And then especially spectroscopy, what is the composition? Is this fresh water ice we're seeing, or are these maybe salt deposits? And again, the good news is that Dawn is heading in closer to Ceres, and we do expect to be able to map out both the 3D structure, the topography of this area, and crucially, we expect to be able to use the spectrometer to actually be able to tell us something about what this stuff is made out of. And I think we will resolve this mystery and see, you know, if there really is something splattered there, or if this is just sort of ice that is being revealed from below.
Back to our part of the solar system, the rocky and wet inner solar system, Venus. You've studied it at great length, David, and you've written of Venus. There is new information consistent with information we have that there are volcanoes on Venus, active volcanoes. What does that mean, David? What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us, if it's true, and you know, I think it's a good piece of work, but it's also a very difficult kind of analysis to make. But if this is correct, it tells us that Venus is alive in the sense that Earth is and most other planets are not. In other words, you have a planet like Mars where it's very interesting in a lot of ways, but there is not active internal geology, volcanoes going off. It's cold inside and the crust is rigid. Venus, being the same size as Earth, roughly, probably has a hot interior like Earth, and so we kind of expect that it would be geologically active, but we have not detected the smoking gun of that yet. But this observation, if it's correct, of these hot spots on the surface of Venus from the Venus Express spacecraft would tell us that, yes, indeed, Venus is a geological survivor like the Earth. And that's exciting because it gives us the prospect of studying active ongoing geology on a nearby world, not just the sort of recreation of ancient geological events like we do on so many planets, but actually the possibility of monitoring activity on an Earth-like planet nearby. So I'm very much hoping this is borne out and that this really is the smoking gun of active volcanoes on Venus, and that introduces a whole new way that we can study a neighbor planet by monitoring this activity in the future.
Dr. David Grinspoon, an astrobiologist at the Library of Congress. These are three of the fresh challenges we have in our solar system for planetary geology. Pluto, there'll be much more, and we'll talk to David in a week's time as New Horizons close by photographs of Pluto. We've never seen this. This is the first time in history they'll write of this for thousands of years. And Ceres, of course, same place. And then the solution of the young surface of our sister planet, Venus. David Grinspoon, I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Anna Nebtsova reporting for the Daily Beast and for Newsweek from the conflict zones around what used to be the Soviet Union but is now the contested Ukraine, and the parts of the former Soviet Union, now parts of the Russian Federation, that are strained by economy and tradition. We begin with Odessa Province, which is a very critical part of Ukraine, the city of Odessa, but the Odessa province borders on Moldova and Romania. This is on the Black Sea Basin. Anna Nemtsova has traveled to Odessa more than once the last 2 years since the conflict, and this time she visited with a young Ukrainian woman. Her name is Yulia Marashevska. She's 25 years old, and she is part of an effort to revive Odessa and Odessa province with better governance. Anna, a very good evening to you. Yulia Marashevska, does she have a role, a job that she performs for the people of Odessa? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Yes, Yulia Marashevska is the advisor for recently appointed Governor Mikhail Saakashvili, who was the president of Georgia and reformed Georgia in mid-2000s. Yulia Marashevska is a famous character in Ukraine. She was famous during Maidan because she produced a video on Ukrainian where she explained why people were risking their lives on Maidan Square, where it was still dangerous to take part in protests. Yulia Marashevska's video was viewed by 8 million people on YouTube. And she was a PhD student at Kiev University. She studied mythology, Ukrainian literature. And soon after, her video was became so popular, she traveled around the world, and everywhere she went, whether she met with UN leaders or she met with Congress in the U.S., she would tell everybody about the Maidan, about the protests, about how Ukraine wants to change and reform. So she became a voice of Ukraine, that young woman. And soon after that, she took a three-month course at Stanford, where her tutor was former ambassador in Moscow, U.S. ambassador in Moscow, Michael McFaul. And today she works with the newly appointed governor, Saakashvili, and trying to help to reform Odessa, to find new bureaucrats to replace the old leading positions in Odessa administration, regional administration, with new people with more than mine. She complains that she faces a lot of post-Soviet signs, of post-Soviet system.
She grew up in the Odessa province bordering Moldova and Romania. Moldova is a breakaway part of the former Soviet Union, and it has separate governance. However, there's another part that is called Transnistria, and that's also attached to the Russian state right now. So this is a conflict zone, or could become a conflict zone. Does she speak of that, Anna, about the trouble that's possible on the borders of Odessa province?
It surprised me that nobody really talks about security issues, neither in Odessa nor in that region where we traveled, called Tatarbunari. People are more concerned about bad roads, about bad medical service, about bureaucrat problems, and people complain a lot about corruption, illegal takeovers of their beaches. They had a chance this time to speak directly to the governor. Saakashvili took a public bus from Odessa to Tatarbunari, where he met with people on the streets of that small provincial town. He wanted to hear from random people about their issues. And it was quite interesting because in less than an hour, there was a huge crowd waiting for Saakashvili on the central square. They just learned that the governor is on his way by a public bus. When he got off the bus, he asked people questions. They asked him questions, and there was a very interesting communication of a high official with local people. Yulia Marashevska was his sort of guide because she comes from that region. She told the governor about her home region a lot, how beautiful it is, that the road to Trbunare is the road that takes you from Odessa to Romania, to European Union. But the road doesn't really exist. It's a terribly bumpy road. So the first thing Saakashvili wanted to promise, he promised people that he would fix that highway. But, you know, promises and reality, they're two different things. And some people believe that Marashevska, Saakashvili, and other team members will succeed reform Odessa, fix the roads, fix the management. And some people are skeptical about it, knowing how deep-rooted, about the scale of deep-rooted corruption in the system.
The politics of Odessa, as I recall, this is a region that has influence that is that both leans towards Russia and Donbass and leans towards Kiev. Is that something they speak of, Saakashvili speaks of, that this is not an entirely pro-Kiev region or city the way, say, Kiev and the western part of the country is?
No, they don't really speak about that. Saakashvili speaks Russian because that's the language that majority of people speak in Odessa.
Right.
But he mostly cares about civil society, about what needs to be changed and how to change it. He meets with business groups, the civil society groups. But as for this aspect, which is actually, you're very right to point it out, John, there's a huge wound in Odessa. What happened last May is actually something that is still there, that pain that people have, the crack between two groups of two different opinions. And to many, that building where 39 people died in fire, it is like a memorial or a grave. People bring flowers there and they cry there. But last Sunday, the governor announced that that building was supposed to become new headquarters for Navy forces, which some people don't like, and some people think that there's so much sadness around that building and inside that building that it should just stay to itself for a while. But Saakashvili is in a hurry to make changes. And that young woman, she's very pretty and she's very energetic, and people like her. So I think that she might become a very interesting politician in Ukraine. I'm curious about her future.
I'm speaking with Anna Nemtsova. She reports for The Daily Beast and for Newsweek. We're speaking of a part of Ukraine, Odessa province, which is on the Black Sea coast. And Anna has been speaking specifically of a crime, an outrage that happened in May of 2014. As of yet, there's no explanation that satisfies everyone as to why the building was on fire, the reports of people being shot as they were trying to escape. In other words, the whole thing remains a controversy and an outrage from points of view. Odessa is where Saakashvili, who was formerly the president of Georgia and has recently lived in the United States, in fact, he lived in Brooklyn until last spring, is now appointed the governor of Odessa, which is a good decision. And also the fact that the U.S. is present in Odessa in helping Saakashvili. The ambassador of the United States to Ukraine was recently in Odessa to talk about how, say, 31 highway patrol officers from California are coming to train Ukrainian police. So there's much work to be done, but as Anna emphasizes, corruption is far more threatening to the people of Odessa region than the war in Donbass. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.